Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Americans love to lavish attention on their lawns. A total of some 40 million acres of lawn dotted with mostly non-native trees and shrubs these days. Then there are the big houses, the never-ending housing developments, and the roads that link them to our cities and the cities to each other. 4 million miles of paved roads. Conservationists say that all those roads and lawns and our penchant for the exotic non-native plants have chipped away at the biodiversity of our environment. And they say that's not an option going forward. Coming up, we'll hear about how to re-diversify your yard. But first, invasive pathogens. That's an important related problem. The emerald ash borer is an invasive species. It's killed millions of ash trees, and more recently, a tiny insect is wiping out the hemlocks that populate much of the Hocking Hills region. Joining me to talk about this is Ohio State University plant disease expert Jim Chatfield. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Hi. Great to be here, Ann.
So what is the connection between these invasive species and biodiversity, these invasive pathogens and biodiversity?
Well, there are invasive pathogens such as fungi and bacteria that cause infectious host parasite diseases of plants. And there's also invasive insects like emerald ash borer, as you mentioned, and the hemlock woolly adelgid insect that's occurring. And there are even invasive plants, so plants that are exotic to the U.S. that are kind of getting out of landscape situations or treescape situations and getting into native areas and replacing those plants. A lot of Asian and European honeysuckles, for example, can be really problems in natural areas like Clifton Gorge Nature Preserve, the best wildflower area in Ohio. You get all these honey locusts in there and even burning bush euonymus that are not native, and they crowd out our native plants. So they're all invasive to their new environment. Eventually, they'll equilibrate, but in our lifetime, they're just really getting in the way of our native areas.
And when you say equilibrate, you mean what?
Well, what I mean is ultimately, I mean, as far as nature is concerned, all these invasive organisms will eventually establish relationships where they're not, you know, crowding out all the other plants. I mean, eventually, everything will be native. I mean, you know, realistically, if we wait a couple million years, the honeysuckles won't be replacing all these native plants. They'll just simply be a plant that's native by then. So the idea of invasiveness is one that you have to really think about what we're talking about. Usually we're talking about pre-European colonization of the U.S. So,
okay.
It, you know, if you find something that's in the fossil record that was here, you'd say, well, it's native. But really what we're really talking about is what has been introduced to this area in reasonably recent years, in a kind of our human sense of the last couple of hundred years or whatever, and how that has changed the environment relative to replacing the species that were here. Now, it's a very complicated situation. Obviously, not every landscape is native. I mean, we were prairie or forest for large portions of Ohio. Well, those environments aren't necessarily here anymore. I mean, in Columbus, within the city limits, there are a lot of environments that aren't what was here 200 years ago. And so, you know, it's always going to be a mix of native plants and non-native plants.
No matter what, it's always changing.
It's always changing. But mm-hmm. The issue is when you have a new introduction, the emerald ash borer, a new introduction, the fungus that causes Dutch elm disease, a new introduction, some of these Japanese and Chinese and European honeysuckles that have been introduced to our landscapes that are now kind of pushing out other things because they don't have natural enemies and those kinds of things.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about biodiversity today, not just in our parks, our national parks, our local parks, and that sort of thing, but also in our own backyard. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. I want to introduce now Steve Cothrell. He is superintendent of Upper Arlington Parks and Forestry. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Let's talk a little bit about the issues of the invasive species of insect that have done so much damage. Did the frigid temperatures this past winter affect pest populations at all? Do you know?
Well, winter weather always affects pest populations, but it's very difficult to predict how the weather will affect a given pest. And we don't have a lot of experience with some of these newer introductions like emerald ash borer. There's been a lot of speculation about what our fairly extreme winter will do or has done to the larvae that are living inside of ash trees. But most of the entomologists that I've spoken with or read of seem to think that while there may be some casualties under the bark, that the larvae were well enough protected here in Ohio that the majority of them will survive, and we have so many of them at this point that I really am not expecting to see a noticeable decline in emerald ash borer activity in 2014.
Jim Chatfield, is that the case from where you sit?
Absolutely. You know, Dave Shetler, who is an entomologist with OSU, always has a statement about this because it comes up whenever we have a particularly harsh winter. He said, I always bet on the insects. So it is complicated, as Steve indicated. I mean, sometimes it depends on not only how well a particular insect survives, but, you know, how well the natural predators of that insect survive. So there's a matrix of different kinds of things that are going on, which influences. With the emerald ash borer, we just don't think it got cold enough in our area. I mean, if we were 30 below for a week, it would be one thing. But, you know, they're inside the tree. They're protected by that bark. Wind chill doesn't count. So we really probably didn't have the temperatures for a tree. Wind chill does not count.
Why doesn't wind chill count?
Well,
if it makes me colder when I go outside, why wouldn't it be more dangerous
Just keep in mind that trees have a skin. They have bark.
That's right.
And so the fact of the matter is that we don't think that that insects in Ohio, that emerald ash borer, I mean, obviously every insect's different, but emerald ash borer in Ohio is going to be significantly changed in terms of their populations.
So let's talk about what's killing the hemlocks. When something like that happens, when there's this species of insect that's going after something like a hemlock or the ash trees or the Dutch elms, do you plant fewer of them? What do you do? Or do you try to plant more and hope they don't become attacked by the insects or the disease or whatever the pathogen might be?
A lot of different strategies. I mean, certainly with emerald ash borer, many, many less ashes are being planted because it is a devastating pest that really is, you know, transforming how many ashes are going to survive in North America. It won't wipe out all our North American ashes, but it's significantly, you know, if you're a nurseryman who was growing ashes 20 years ago, you're not growing them anymore. So, at least in our part of the country where emerald ash borer is here. So, sometimes you have to look for alternatives. Ironically, one of the common alternatives to ash, and Steve will back this up, is hybrid elms. So, elms have made it back into with some elms that have greater resistance to Dutch elm disease. But sometimes it's growing different plants. Sometimes with hemlock woolly adelgid, massive problem further east from us. We're still hoping that we can get this under control. So they're somewhat isolated situations where the hemlock woolly adelgid has come in and caused this problem. So, you know, eradication is a real potential way to deal with it, bringing in natural predators, beetles, and also natural pathogens, fungi that can help control and knock back the population of the hemlock woolly adelgid is a reasonable strategy. So it's usually a mix of strategies, but certainly one thing that oftentimes happens is if the pest is bad enough, it means you're going to plant, you know, for example, with emerald ash borer, we're going to plant less ashes. And that's what's happened already.
Steve Cuthrell, I know in Worthington where I live, they did plant a lot of those disease-resistant elms in the parks along the river. I think they were provided, or it was some kind of collaboration with the United States Forest Service or something like that. What about in Upper Arlington? How do you what is your strategy when it comes to something like the hemlock problem coming up? Hopefully not. Or the emerald ash borer?
Well, with respect to hemlock, I think we'll always have hemlocks in the urban landscape, because treating for the adelgid is not that difficult.
Okay.
And some people love hemlocks, but my concern as a classically trained forester is for the hemlocks in our natural forests, particularly in southern Ohio, where hemlock fills a fairly unique ecological niche, and those trees typically are not going to be treated. And we really risk, in the long run, losing those hemlock forests. And they are majestic and amazing places. So that part of it has me very concerned. With respect to ash trees, Upper Arlington was fortunate in that we did not have entire subdivisions filled with ash like some communities have. But we identified emerald ash borer as a problem shortly after it was discovered. We monitored it for a couple of years and then in 2004 stopped planting ash as a precaution. 2006, we adopted an emerald ash borer management plan that actually recommended removal of healthy ash trees in a phased process. So we've been removing ash trees since 2006, even though we did not actually discover emerald ash borer in Upper Arlington until 2009. And we replace everything we remove. We went from about 750 street trees in the genus Fraxinus, all the native ashes, and we're down to less than 100 now. We just have some small ones left. We're in the process of removing those now. And when we replace, we look at a lot of different site factors, and we try to strive for diversity. So there is no one good replacement for ash trees. It all depends on site characteristics and landowner objectives. And in the case of street trees, we like canopy. We want to plant the largest tree that the site will support in most cases, but a lot of street tree sites don't support really large native trees. So we are using exotic species and native species, but I think I should clarify, exotic does not mean invasive. Only a select number of exotic species become invasive.
I want to bring into the conversation now Sarah Ernst. She's the conservation specialist for the Franklin Soil and Water Conservation District. By the way, their 2014 tree and fish sale is open. For more information, you can go to the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Before we take a quick break, I wanted to talk about something that both Steve and Jim have brought up, and that's that this is about more than just the trees themselves. There's a whole, particularly say down in Hocking Hills is a good example, the hemlocks down there, they are part of a much larger, hugely important part of a much larger ecosystem. Talk a little bit about it. It's not just about losing the plants themselves, but the other plants that depend on those plants to grow, and then all the wildlife as well.
Well, sure. I mean, losing an important species like the hemlock means you're losing all of the insects and herbivores that depend on that particular species. So it's sort of a chain link effect. If we lose one species, we're losing the species that depend on that one. And so we always encourage people to plant for diversity, not only for trees, but also for the subcanopy, for the shrub layer, for the herbaceous layer. There's a lot of potential there.
We are going to continue our conversation about biodiversity when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We're talking about the importance of plant diversity in our environment, and we're not talking about the public parks alone, but we're talking about your own backyard as well. Still with us, OSU plant disease expert Jim Chatfield. Joining us now is Franklin Soil and Water Conservation. Well, still with us is Franklin Soil and Water Conservation District conservation expert Sarah Ernst, and also Superintendent of Upper Arlington's Parks and Forestry Steve Cothrell. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Steve, I mentioned earlier that a lot of people are counting on the parks to give us the diversity we need, that they think that that's enough. And what kind of challenges do you have in terms of diversity when it's just, you know, the parks against the rest of the world?
Well, as an urban forester, I try to manage to the extent that I can the urban forest canopy in the entire community. And although I focus most of my attention on street trees and on parks, mm-hmm. the majority of the canopy in any Ohio community is on private property in people's front and backyards. I don't have direct control over that, nor do I want it. But, you know, that's an education challenge. And, you know, the emerald ash borer is a great example. Everybody wants to know, what should I plant instead of ash? And there is no simple answer to that question. You really need an expert to come out and take a look and talk to you. But in terms of our parks, we do use them as laboratories to some extent, because creating a diverse street tree canopy is not easy, because street tree growing conditions are always a challenge. When new cultivars or species are introduced in the nursery trade, I'm usually hesitant to introduce those in front of somebody's house without knowing the tree to some degree. So we'll plant them in the parks first and see how they do for a few years.
Why not in front of somebody's house versus the park? What's...
When I plant something that fails miserably in a park, I'm the one who notices it the most. Okay. If I plant it in front of your house and it fails miserably, that's not a happy situation.
Do you feel like you know every tree in your parks?
Pretty well, yes, I do. And I try to keep an eye on them. And we actually have something called Tree Treks on the city's website. You can get self-guided brochures that allow you to educate yourself about the great variety of trees we have in four of our parks, because we do have literally dozens and dozens of different species and varieties in all of our sizable parks.
Sarah Ernst, when people come to you at the Franklin Soil and Water Conservation District, and maybe they're going to go through the plant, go to the plant sale online and check it out and buy something, how do you get a lot of questions at this time of year with the plant sale on how to replace an ash, or what to replace an ash tree with, that kind of a thing?
Yeah, we do. We usually ask what they're looking for. We ask them what kind of space they have, what characteristics they prefer.
Yeah. And so how much time can you really spend with people when we're talking about that? Because as Steve said, it's complicated.
Yeah, it's complicated. We can sometimes take a look at their property in person. Sometimes we'll look at aerials. We'll see if there's anything about the soil type or maybe the topography of the land that would limit any particular kind of tree or that would favor another kind of species. You know, in some cases, we're looking at areas that are in the right-of-ways or that may be very close to a neighbor's property. So we always want to take those factors into consideration.
People are really getting into gardening now for vegetables. And I was wondering, you need a lot of sun for that.
Uh-huh.
And if you're seeing that people are less interested in trees in order to provide that. I know our garden is right smack in the middle of our yard because that's the only place we have sun. Everything else around it is shade trees.
Yeah, there's no way to get around that. If you want a vegetable garden, you usually do need
a lot of sun.
At least 6 hours or more a day, yeah.
I wanted to go back to the... to what Steve Cotherell was saying just a minute ago, Jim Chatfield, about the canopy issue and how important that is. When we were off the air, you were talking about a neighborhood or some Toledo neighborhoods that had an interesting problem with that.
Well, right. I mean, one of the things that is a great collective memory, I suppose it's becoming less so by the year, was the wonderful overarching streets of elms that we had in Ohio, where Dutch elm disease was first recognized in the United States, was in Ohio in the 30s. But they were wonderful trees that overarched and created quite a nice tunnel. And interestingly enough, although ashes don't quite do the same thing, they can oftentimes provide a little bit of that sense of things. And so one of the impulses in Toledo, even knowing that diversity is very important, was, you know, once they've lost that sense of community that they had with those overarching elms, well, they planted ashes because they could kind of provide that same sort of thing. So they got kind of hit by the double whammy once in the early 2000s, emerald ash borer moved in and took out those ash trees. And it's quite a dramatic thing for all those who have been in a neighborhood that was shaded and cool, and suddenly you have a very barren, hot, you know, there's the sidewalk, there's the, you just don't have that protection from the heat. And so it's quite you realize how important trees can be to you. Actually, urban forestry in the United States got its first great start as a profession and as a people putting great attention to it from Dutch elm disease. And in some ways, this realization of what happens when you lose something is going to also keep us focused on how important trees can be, how important trees are environmentally, in terms of all the environmental services they provide, and then also teach us once again that diversity is crucial.
Urban forestry just keeps getting, it has to keep getting bigger and bigger because our urban areas keep getting bigger and bigger. The challenge, I mean, it's like a full employment guarantee for you going down the road, right?
It is. You know, we are becoming a more urban society right. every year. So the urban areas are where people interact with trees and nature to the extent that they still do.
Dan in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi.
Fascinating subject. This is a question for any or all of your guests about addressing homeowners' concerns who have ash trees that they care about. I've done some research on the effectiveness of trunk injections or basal drenches. Could your guests, I'll need to hang up and hear the answer, but could your guests just address the homeowner's concerns as far as pros and cons of working with an arborist to deliver, you know, effective treatment over a number of years versus just saying, you know, a tree that has not yet been infested greatly, knowing that it costs a lot to cut it down and replant it, too. Mm. So pros and cons for both.
All right.
I thank you for your guest time.
Thank you, Dan.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
So well, there's oh,
to save or not to save.
Well, there was a certain amount of confusion early on with emerald ash borer, and people would ask questions probably of Steve in Upper Arlington and certainly of Ohio State University. What's your policy on whether we should treat for emerald ash borer? And quickly, especially as we learned how much the emerald ash borer had already spread unknowingly to us by the time we started paying attention to it, we recognize that eradication programs, trying to get rid of all those, taking out trees just to make sure that they didn't spread from one area, we realized that that wasn't going to work because it was already too widespread. So the idea became we can't stop the emerald ash borer. So, you know, in terms of societally trying to, you know, eliminate trees to create a fire break between where they are and where they were going, that didn't work. In terms of using vast amounts of public funds to try to treat whole cities and whole forested areas, that became kind of a non-starter. But in terms of control of emerald ash borer on individual trees of significance to people, they can be controlled. So they can be prevented with injections of insecticide. So emerald ash borer can be controlled with insecticide applications. Using arborists to make those applications, a very good idea. The issue is simply the extent to which that tree is important to you. And there are all kinds of reasons it can be important to you in terms of, you know, the kind of shade it's provided your family, in terms of the aesthetic beauty, in terms of the environmental benefits that a tree provides. You know, my numbers here can be checked by anybody out there if they go to treebenefits.com. But if you took maybe a 24-inch diameter ash tree and looked at the environmental services that tree provides in terms of stormwater remediation, in terms of energy savings for a tree, for example, air conditioning in the summer, in terms of their carbon sequestration, their air quality improvement, you know, we're probably talking about $150 of environmental benefits, for example, to the city of Upper Arlington per year for that standing tree. So the beauty of it, the history for your family, the environmental services it's providing, that you're going to take a long time to ever get that again by replanting a new tree, those are all major considerations as you then evaluate, well, will I treat or will I not treat? But if you do not have a major infestation where they're already badly declining, mm-hmm. emerald ash borer can be controlled by insecticides. Nobody's going to do it on a citywide basis. But for individual trees, it's all a matter of a decision by the homeowner.
How much you can afford year by year versus the...
Right.
If it's cost to have the tree cut
right.
down, which can be significant in one.
Right. And it's not going to be a one-year treatment. I mean, you're going to have to keep
right.
treating that for the foreseeable future.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We have an email from Jim in Grandview. I think you pretty much answered his question, but I want to make sure. Will we ever be free of the emerald ash borer? That is, once the borers have killed all the vulnerable ash trees in an area, will the borers die off, thereby making it safe to plant ash trees again? And
it's nice to think that that could happen. They'll all starve to death once they've used up, but it's probably going to be like the chestnut blight.
Which was?
So that we had a fungal disease that moved into our American chestnuts in the early 1900s. Basically, it's hard to even imagine this, but one-fourth of the number of trees in the Appalachian area were American chestnuts. One-half of the biomass of the vegetative life in the Appalachian area was American chestnuts. And now they're a tiny tenth or hundredth of one percentage. So what's happened is that almost all of the American chestnuts, not all, and there are still some out there, but the original American chestnuts, the straight trees we're hybridizing now, they were basically almost completely decimated. But guess what's happened? There's still a resident population. Usually what happens is the tree makes it up to about the period where it reproduces, and then the stress of putting all the energy into reproduction stresses the tree a little extra, and the fungus is still out there. So 100 years later, and it'll be true 200 years later, the fungus is still there. And so typically what happens, it'll get up to a certain size, reproduces, and then at least we'll survive, but then it dies because the fungus is still there. Okay, so the tree, a tree, when it reproduces, it has flowers and, you know, flowers and fruits. So one of the things about American chestnut is it's not going to be completely gone because we get trees that survive at least long enough to produce fruits, and then the seeds, and then the new seedlings will come up. But most of those trees die before they're really all that big.
Okay.
And then the fungus is still out there killing those trees as they reach a certain size. So there's an equilibrium right now between the chestnut blight fungus and American chestnut trees. That's what's going to happen for the foreseeable future, in my opinion, with all of our North American ashes. There will be less North American ashes. There will be less, eventually, emerald ash borers. But there's probably going to be resident populations that will kill off ashes. And so we're not going to starve them to death by eventually not having enough ashes. Now, if we wait thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of years perhaps, then our American, North American ashes will be like Asian ashes. In other words, the survivors through natural selection are going to be survivors that have something that helps them resist genetically the emerald ash borer. The Asian ashes are not as susceptible because that's where the insect comes from. That's where the insect and the plant have co-evolved together for long periods of time. Eventually, that'll happen here. We're just not willing to wait thousands or millions of years.
Well, then eventually something else will come along.
Eventually, it'll all be part of nature. Diseases and insect pests are not unnatural. That's something to keep in mind. This is all part of nature.
Yes, yeah, Sarah Ernst, you mentioned earlier when we were talking about the other things that depend on the trees, you said there's insects. There's other insects out there that depend on trees being there.
Oh, yeah, certainly. We're learning a lot about the relationships between native insects and their host plants. And a lot of people have become very interested in wildlife gardening and butterfly gardens. But we have to remember we need the host plants there too, or else we won't get the adults that we like so much. But there are some species, in particular oak trees, that support, you know, over 500 species of butterflies and moths. If we don't have those, then we don't have, in a large part, the terrestrial birds that depend on them. But everything, to some degree, depends so much on insects to get by.
And we need insects.
We need a healthy insect population. And truthfully, only a very small percentage does harm to us, but the rest are aerating the soil. They're serving as valuable decomposers, helping to enrich the soil, and they help keep the harmful insects in check.
And we haven't brought up birds yet, but the effect on the songbird population is huge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and we know we've been losing populations of migratory songbirds for some decades now. You know, we know the monarch is in trouble. And we know about the European honeybee, but our native pollinators, which we see less of, are actually very efficient pollinators as well. And so if you're interested in even vegetable gardening, you've got to have the bugs there to help you out.
We have an email from a listener. They write, many local volunteer groups are working with the Parks Administration to remove honeysuckle from parks. It crowds out native plants and provides cover for illegal activity. If you hear chainsaws and a chipper in a park, you'll find volunteers working for the parks. Steve Cothrell, is that the case in Arlington Parks?
Well, it is, yes, including a little bit of that illicit activity. The Asian honeysuckles form an incredibly dense mass in the understory. I think a lot of Franklin County residents have forgotten that in a native Ohio forest, you should be able to take a leisurely stroll through the woods. And that's virtually impossible once that honeysuckle understory establishes.
And the multiflora?
Multiflora rose is another problem, especially in forest areas that have some sun coming through the canopy. We actually have a volunteer group in Upper Arlington called the UA Weed Warriors, and they have, for the last couple of years, taken considerable honeysuckle out of our natural areas in our parks, and the difference is dramatic. And even the very next growing season, you'll see some native wildflowers and other native plants come back that were not able to survive when the honeysuckle was present.
Sarah Ernst, what do you recommend for people who love the honeysuckle in their yard? They love how it smells. They love what it looks like. But it's creating, you know, it's part of the problem is what people have put in their yards, right? So what is an alternative?
Oh, gosh, there are lots of great alternatives out there. For a screening effect, you might try something like a viburnum. We have a number of native species. We've got some very nice dogwoods. For a shady situation, I would think about something like spicebush. For wet situations, maybe something like buttonbush. There's so many alternatives that won't get out of control like the honeysuckle, and that have, you know, that have lovely flowers that smell nice and still will attract some healthy insect populations.
And how hard is it to get rid of a honeysuckle? Do you have to dig it out by the roots, or can you just cut it down to the nub, or what?
Well, there are a number of different strategies. To get it out by the roots is the best.
Okay.
Oftentimes, you're not sure that you've gotten the whole plant. Sometimes there's a foliar spray that's applied to the entire plant in the fall.
Okay.
Yeah, for us, it depends on when we're attacking it and the size of the plant. Little plants are actually fairly easy to pull out of moist soil, but most of our work is either spraying the entire plant in the fall, because honeysuckle keeps its leaves longer than native plants, or cutting it and then treating the sprouts that result from the stump. But if you cut it and don't treat the stump, it will come roaring back with a vengeance.
So you need to repeatedly treat it, or else it will come back to see you
once again.
It's one of the interesting things, I think, about invasive plants. It's kind of a little bit of a where the rubber meets the road, because sometimes people that are very interested in natural areas are not very interested in using pesticides. And suddenly, though, they realize that herbicides, which are types of pesticides that kill plants, may seem a little bit more amenable to use. When you need to get rid of a big, massive infestation of larger honeysuckles, then you're starting to think, I wonder if some of those herbicides might not be a good thing. So there's always those really interesting dilemmas that occur whenever you try to nurture nature. There's a great saying, you can drive out nature with a pitchfork, but she always returns. And so that balancing out between nature and nurture, and actually nurture is what horticulture is about, is really an interesting thing. If you're interested in looking at honeysuckles and say, well, what are these plants that we're talking about? One of the interesting ways that they have such a great advantage, the Asian honeysuckle species have a great advantage. They leaf out before most of everything else that's woody. So if you drive along the interstate and what's all that new stuff that's starting to leaf out, that light green color, a lot of that is honeysuckle hedges. If you look in the woods and you go to Clifton Gorge or you go to a park and you'll notice that understory tree, before the trees have leafed out, there's honeysuckles, Asian honeysuckles. And of course, that's a huge advantage physiologically, because the earlier you start photosynthesizing, producing food in the leaves from the sun, you have an edge over most plants if you're leafing out first.
Does that create an edge for the people who want to eradicate it then, too? Is springtime a good time to go for this stuff?
It helps in the springtime with identification.
Okay.
Because volunteers need to be able to tell honeysuckle from the more desirable plants. But typically, the foliar spraying in the spring is not as effective because all of the plant's energy is surging upward. That's why we like to do the foliar sprays in the fall. Okay. That's when the plant is storing things in the root system for the winter.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Native plants have become something of a rarity in our yards, and that's affecting more than the view. The shrinking diversity of plants in our environment and the increase in non-native species invites disease and removes precious habitat for wild animals. But experts say that we can help one yard at a time. Still with us, OSU plant disease expert Jim Chatfield, also Sarah Ernst with the Franklin Soil and Water Conservation District, and Steve Cotherell. He's superintendent of Upper Arlington Parks and Forestry. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. And just want to remind folks that the Franklin Soil and Water Conservation District's 2014 tree and fish sale is open. So for more information, go to the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Steve Cotherell, you wanted to talk about the gypsy moth. First of all, there's going to be some aerial spraying of it in Upper Arlington, you said. What is the gypsy moth? Why do they call it the gypsy moth anyway?
Well, the gypsy moth travels, apparently. I don't know how else it got that name.
Don't all insects, isn't that the problem?
But, it travels on campers easily.
Oh, okay. I see. It hitches rides.
It spends a lot of the year as eggs, which are very sticky and will attach, the adults attach to a lot of different things. The gypsy moth is not native to North America, but it was brought here intentionally by an amateur entomologist in Massachusetts and in the 1860s.
To study it.
To study it, right. And to attempt to breed cold hardy silkworms.
Okay.
And unfortunately, he had a little mistake at the lab, and they got loose. And he notified the town authorities in Massachusetts at the time, but nobody thought it was a big deal. And the gypsy moth has been slowly moving its way westward across North America ever since. And it is not nearly as rapid a traveler as the emerald ash borer. The adult gypsy moth female does not fly, so they move very slowly. It's taken well over 100 years for them to really establish in Ohio as a permanent population. But they have built up a healthy enough population here in Franklin County that the Ohio Department of Agriculture is planning to do some aerial treatments of several areas in Franklin County this spring, including Upper Arlington.
What do they do to hurt the trees?
The adult moth actually doesn't bother trees to any significant degree, but the larvae are little hairy caterpillars with red and blue spots on them.
Okay.
And when the population spikes in a given year due to weather and other factors, they will defoliate the tree. They love oaks and a handful of other species in particular, and they will chew every leaf off of the tree, every leaf out of a neighborhood in a worst-case scenario.
And in addition to the angst that people suffer with the loss of this foliage, when they really get bad, people can hear them. So imagine that you're in a wooded area or on a wooded property, and you can actually hear insects munching on leaves.
That's just
not a good mental health day.
That's just wrong. It's bad enough knowing they're out there. We have several emails. We have some calls that we want to get to. Sarah Ernst, first of all, though, could you tell us a little bit about the tree and fish sale this year? What's different? What's new? What you do?
Well, we do this every year. It's for the purposes of conservation, so prices are pretty reasonable.
So it's not necessarily a fundraiser?
No, it's not.
Okay.
But we've got a variety of different native trees. We have tree packets. You know, for instance, we've got the ash replacement packet, which has been popular for a few years, obviously. We've got a honeysuckle replacement packet. We've got a shady area, stream side packet, songbird packet. My favorite is the bees, bugs, and butterfly packet.
All right.
That features a number of trees and smaller shrubs that attract native bugs that I like so much. And that we've got a variety of native perennials as well.
Okay, so you can check that out at wosu.org/allsides. We'll have a link to the sale. It's, of course, online. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. And Jeffrey in Worthington, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Just have a brief question. I have a piece of property that has two streams in it, and there's a ravine. And previously, that ravine had grass, and it was mowed and so forth, and I'm letting it just go back to what it was. or where it's going. And part of that is getting the honeysuckle under control. And I do dig it out, but I miss a piece and it comes back up. And I was wondering if there's any herbicide or herbicide that I could use without, I'm concerned about the water.
Okay.
And so in spraying an herbicide, is there a one that has a short life that would only affect the plants and degrade, you know, otherwise if it's not on the plant? Or is there something safe I can use?
Well, when we treat honeysuckle in Upper Arlington, we use glyphosate, which is a generic form of Roundup. There are surfactants in most glyphosate blends that are not safe to use around aquatic areas. But if you look at a local garden center, there are glyphosate products out there that don't have those surfactants in them and are labeled for safe use around streams and ponds and such.
And there are even, I mean, and this isn't something you'd be doing typically on a homeowner level, but there are even glyphosate products that are used for weed control in ponds. So it's not necessarily that the glyphosate is going to cause major hazards if you use them properly. And again, as Steve says, you use the particular and specific product. And it's always important to remember that. Look carefully at that label on that product that you're buying, because when Steve's talking about surfactants, it's different kinds of materials that are added to the herbicide itself, the glyphosate, which do different things, make it stick to surfaces, make it spread better. So it's very important to read very carefully the label itself. So it can be used safely, but you have to be careful about the particular product you're using and how you apply it.
And you can get that kind of thing like a glyphosate at any kind of garden department. Or nursery type
popular
thing.
Product.
Right. Okay. Great. Thanks a lot, Jeffrey, for that call. Beth in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Beth.
Hi there. I was wondering if you could discuss the practice that we see happening every spring where people make these cones of mulch around their trees and how it affects the trees and how we can educate people on the proper way to apply mulch. Thank you.
Thank
I'll take
you,
my
Beth.
Answer off the phone. Bye.
All right. The cones of, not shame, but cones of mulch. Who wants to take a swat at that?
What we'd like to see is 2-2.5 inches of organic mulch. Take it all out, all the way to the drip line or even beyond if you could. But 2-2.5 inches of organic mulch is what we'd like to see, and not 2-2.5 inches per year. I mean, not all of it's going to break down every year. So if you applied 2.5 inches every year, you'd eventually end up with too much. We often talk about in our programs at OSU Extension the mismulching of America, and it really is a significant problem. Unfortunately, a lot of customers, and landscapers will tell you this, a lot of customers love the cones of mulch. They just like to see it. It looks tidy. It looks interesting to them. We don't want that much organic matter right around the bark of the tree, and we don't want it that deep, but it can be a major problem. I once did we'll say that it was in Michigan so that we can feel better about it, but we went to a landscape company in Michigan where they were having a terrible problem with the dying of a whole bunch of different plants. They were just declining over time, and so they had these big, giant mulch rings that they had, which were about 8 to 12 inches. And so we go through these neighborhoods, and you could spot them immediately. I said, "Now, what are you doing here? Why are these things so deep?" "This is the trademark of our company, these big mulch rings." I said, "Yes, but remember, why are you bringing me up here today to look at these?" "Well, because we're having so many problems with these plants." And I said, "So that's the real trademark of your company, is it not?" So don't mulch so deeply. 2-2.5 inches is perfect. And it's really, mulch is great, but don't do too much.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Beth, for that suggestion on topics. 614-292-8513 if you have a quick question. John in Johnstown, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I own 3 acres of woods, first time I've ever owned a woods. And I'm so excited. I've been here a year, and I've seen the change. But I know I've got just thick with grapevines that are into the canopy and pulling the saplings down, what to do with those. And also if there's any management resources that I could start looking at.
Sarah Ernst, any ideas for John, as far as resources go?
As far as resources
go. How to grow a forest?
I don't know that I have got resources off the top of my, my head here, but grapevine can certainly be a problem in that it strangles trees.
Is that what it is grapevine?
Yeah, and it's native. However, in a lot of edge habitats, it tends to become a problem. And it could be cut at the base.
But that's about it?
Yeah, it's similar to the honeysuckle. It's going to take some vigilance on your part. But anything you can do to identify the non-native species, a grapevine is native, but it can be problematic. But anything you can do to remove those.
You said at the edge.
Yeah, it tends to move in less established woodlots.
Okay.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Couple of good resources. Ohio State University has a group called the Woodland Stewards. Kathy Smith, just a fantastic forester. And so woodlandstewards.osu.edu is a great resource for small woodlot education and all kinds of really great information on that site, but then also moving forward from there. Ohio Department of Natural Resources also, Division of Forestry, really can help people with their service foresters, helping people in their communities with their small woodlots. So I can't tell you right offhand the website, but if you go to ODNR's websites, certainly great resources for that, as well as the woodlandstewards.osu.edu.
All right, John, I hope that helps. Email from Bob: neighbors on each of the sides of my backyard have allowed a small nuisance tree, I think buckthorn, to spread along my fence line, and I have to trim back the branches that encroach on my property. This tree spreads rapidly and sends up fast-growing sprouts from stumps. I don't think my neighbors planted the first ones of these trees. Rather, I think birds brought in the seeds, and my neighbors didn't remove the trees soon after they were established. My point, diversity in our backyard does not just come from what we plant. It also comes from eradicating the fast-growing nuisance species, so it's what we take out. But the bird thing is an interesting point.
We have a lot of angry birds out there.
You mean they're back? Yeah, right.
No, I'm just playing on Angry Birds, but birds are—they really do disseminate seeds very easily, and so there are all kinds of ways that these infestations occur. And of course, that's the issue with invasive plants, is that they get spread around in very natural ways, and pretty soon they become problems.
Yeah, and they do tend to be very prolific at producing seeds, more so than our native species, and so they do get spread further and further and wider.
Because they don't have the natural...
Right, and oftentimes...
Predators, or whatever you call it.
Right.
Natural defenses.
Yeah, and we see that they're not particularly nutritious, but birds will eat them if there's nothing else available.
There's a wonderful organization called the Ohio Invasive Plant Council, and what they're trying to do, and it's a consortium of people from natural area people to nurserymen to people trying to really help kind of get an angle on this process. And one of the things that's an issue is if you introduce a new plant to the U.S., obviously we introduce a lot of plants that, are kind of really cool plants that you want to plant. Is there a good protocol for determining what their potential for invasiveness is? And it's a very difficult process. But what Sarah is saying is exactly right, is the things that are looked at now as we start thinking about this a little bit more carefully is, how many seeds do these plants produce? Is there some self-sterility here? Do they easily breed? How many of those seeds germinate typically? All those kind of biological factors. And, again, those things like that honeysuckle that the leaves come out earlier, so they photosynthesize earlier, so they have a big advantage. Can they fix nitrogen in the soil? Certain plants can do that, like autumn olive. And so it's looking at those different aspects of a plant's biology and what might make it a potential invasive problem down the road.
Takes a little bit more thought than what you just think looks good is kind of the point of it all, is you want people to get more involved in the biology of it and not just the aesthetics of it. Well, I want to thank all of you for joining us today. Steve Cothrell, he's superintendent of Upper Arlington Parks and Forestry. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
Also, Jim Chatfield, OSU professor of plant pathology. Thank you for joining us today.
Great fun, Ann.
And Sarah Ernst, she's a conservation specialist for Franklin Soil and Water Conservation District. Sarah, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Ann.
And the Franklin Soil and Water Conservation District's 2014 Tree and Fish Sale is open. For more info, you can go to the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks so much for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.